You know, my dream is that if there were a critical mass of people tapping into their genius, which is every single child that is born. Tagore said every child that is born is proof that God has not given up on human beings. So my hope would be that if there's a critical mass of people who wake up from the waking sleep that they're in and stop being biological robots, then we could hope for a more peaceful, just, sustainable, healthier, and joyful world.
That voice won't need an introduction for many of you. Dr. Deepak Chopra is here today on the Beautiful Writers podcast. And lucky for me, your host, Linda Sievertson, we are his very first stop on book tour for his new book, Metahuman, Unleashing Your Infinite Potential. It pubs next month via Harmony Books. Our guest co-host today is Ariel Ford, who was greatly responsible for making Deepak a household name as his longtime past book publicist. This was before she became the author of 11 books, including the hit The Soulmate Secret. And this is her current favorite of Deepak's books, which is a big statement because she witnessed greatness at work with regard to one of his early hits that would sell millions of copies. Remember the 7 spiritual laws of success juggernaut? Yeah, Ariel was with Deepak one afternoon back in the early 90s as they sat in her car and he dictated that book to his publisher on her car phone. That's how we got so blessed here today, to have the author of 86, 90, 91 books, depending on whether or not you're counting those titles, already in stores or in the pipeline. By some great happenstance or good karma, maybe I cleaned a lot of toilets in a past life or frankly in this life, I'm blessed to call Ariel one of my oldest and dearest friends. She and I were chatting about her novel In Progress the other day, and I said, hey, maybe it's time to interview Deepak together. And she said, well, it just so happens he has a new book coming out and he's about to leave on tour in like 5 minutes. And here we are. That's just a reminder to listen to your gut when it whispers a directive. I had never asked Ariel about interviewing Deepak before, but it appears that the time was right. People can't say yes unless you ask. Okay, we have a ton to cover in this chat. I'm sure you want to hear about how we can shift from mere mortals, humans, to metahumans, right? Deepak says it's time to become what we are always meant to be. It is a timely concept, the only real hope for humanity, as he sees it, a way off the rat wheel, the way beyond the wheel. You're going to love it. I also think you're going to love hearing about his extremely committed meditation schedule. Good Lord, good luck trying this one at home. I am not the best meditator these days, preferring to write instead when I have quiet time, but I have downloaded several of Deepak and Oprah's joint meditation tapes over the last 2 years, and I highly, highly recommend them. Want to know what Deepak says is the window into infinite creativity? Yep, we cover that. We also get him to share his favorite author and book, which also happens to be Ariel's husband's favorite book, so I ordered that one immediately. We're going to talk nighttime sleep rituals, guilty pleasures, how to become a spontaneous genius, and why he says today's leaders are mostly thugs. But have no fear, because it's all an illusion. Well, even if the man Time Magazine described as one of the top heroes and icons of the century is right about that, I think you'll appreciate Deepak's tips for upgrading our illusion out of the collective nightmare. I am all for that. Or maybe a stiff drink. I actually don't drink. But speaking of, Ariel wanted a tequila after this conversation, as you'll hear, because I kept the recorder running after Deepak hung up. I mean, girlfriend's got to break it down, right? Surely he won't begrudge us that we were gossiping about him on air behind his back. A career killer, perhaps? Yeah, he's pretty non-judgmental these days, that Deepak, so I'm just not going to stress about it. Here we go. Welcome.
Deepak, I've long been inspired by your friendship with Ariel and the things that you two have been able to do in the world. And to me, you're both super magical. So when you think about Ariel, is there any particular trait or experience that comes to mind that makes you smile or that you're especially grateful for?
She's totally crazy. I'd like to hang out with sages, psychotics, and geniuses, and she's all three like me.
I would totally agree with you, and I would tell the story, but I don't know if I can, but boy, is it wacko.
Yeah, she's wacko, like all of us, I think. In these crazy times, unless you're wacko, you're joining the collective insanity.
Oh, I love it. Ariel, along those same lines, what about Deepak makes your heart happy?
Well, I am particularly fond of low-maintenance people. I have a severe allergy to divas, and there is not a diva bone in his body. And all the years that we worked together, I never heard him say the word no or why to me.
Whoa.
whatever I would ask him to do, it's like, yeah, fine, sure. And he's just easy to be with. He's fun. He's completely curious. And yes, he's a little wacko and crazy. It runs in the family. We go back lifetimes, which is nice to reconnect with the tribe. But of all the people I've met in my life, and I've met tens of thousands, he's always the one I look forward to the most to hanging out with.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Dig it.
Ditto here.
I want to start with some writing questions before we get to the new book. Many of our listeners are writers, and they look forward to hearing best practices from our guests. So you've written 86 books. I don't even know how to wrap my mind around how astounding that is. Did you have this vision for yourself when you were a kid? Did you see this writing career early on?
Not specifically. I always wanted to be a writer, but I wanted to write fiction. And when I was 14 years old, my dad, who wanted me to be a physician, actually, Ariel knew my dad very well. He gave me some books where all the protagonists in these novels were physicians. So I decided I'd go to medical school. I ended up doing that, and that actually helped my career as a writer as well.
Yeah, no kidding.
Deepak, did anybody along the way ever prophesize your writing career? Did you see a psychic or a guru or somebody who said, hey, sir, someday you're going to be a famous writer?
Actually, no. I had a friend in school, in, I think, junior high school. His name was Opu, and this was in a small state in India called Assam, in the foothills of the Himalayas. He was a very good writer. He wanted to be a journalist. And so I used to model myself after him. I was in awe of his writing, even in junior high. So in a sense, he inspired me. And then I read great writers like Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain and the great Russian writers like Dostoevsky and Pushkin. And then much later, Somerset Maugham, and classical writers of great novels. It's very interesting that in many of these great books, including Dr. Zhivago, the protagonist was always a physician or a healer. So I think that influenced me.
Now, how about you, Ariel? 11 books. What did you see for yourself when you were a kid? Did anyone see this path
for you? It was not predictable at the end of the day I would end up as an expert on love and relationships, but I always did enjoy writing. And my goal, I went to the University of Florida, I was in the School of Journalism, and my plan was to graduate and become a photojournalist for Life magazine. And on my 21st birthday, right after I graduated college, Life magazine went out of business. That was it. They were done. So, no, I never saw this coming. And right now I'm writing a novel, and for sure I never saw that coming. So I've learned just to stop trying to plan my life and just hope for the best.
Yeah. None of us saw the novel coming. I remember when you called me and said, Linda, I had a really bizarre idea happen. And I thought, God, I wish that would happen to me. I wish I'd wake up with a novel.
Oh, my God. It's pure torture. And it's the most fun, creative thing I've ever done. And, well, and Deepak is the inspiration for the hero in my book. That's all I can say so far. I know that it has the same name. Yes.
Well, I've read part of your novel, and that first 50 pages is so, it's so not your voice. There's no self-help. It sounds like something that I would see in a movie theater, a hit movie. I mean, oh, I love The Voice.
Well, hopefully you'll come to opening night with me, because I've already decided that Meera Nair is going to direct my movie. She doesn't know that yet, but she will. I'm going to start stalking her soon.
I love it. Okay, so Deepak, you were just saying that going to medical school really influenced your writing. And I wanted to ask you about that, because Ariel told me that when she was first publicizing your books, you had asked her to take the MD off of your name, which is the opposite, I imagine, of what everybody else does. So can you explain?
Well, I think I told Ariel that in 1988, when I wrote my book, Quantum Healing, and even though it had a good review in the New England Journal of Medicine, it was basically vilified by the American medical establishment as being fraudulent, that I was co-opting the word quantum, and that I had no business even using the phrase quantum healing. And at that time, I was actually practicing in Boston, and there were rumors that I would be fired. I was already teaching at BU School of Medicine in Tufts and Harvard and in a group practice, and I knew that my colleagues were embarrassed by the fact that I was an MD and saying what they thought were outrageous things. So I decided for a while to get rid of the MD and get out of their way.
Wow. You know, that's interesting, because our mutual friend, Gabby Bernstein, she was told when she was young by a bully in like the sixth grade that she was stupid. And so schooling was a very kind of contentious thing for her. And then Martha Beck, on the whole other side of the story, Martha Beck has 3 degrees from Harvard, and she believes that college is an antiquated system that needs to be minimized in the role of lots of people, but writers especially, that you don't need to go to college to have a story to tell. But I love the idea that your going to medical school, in many ways, I think, did affect your writing in a positive way. Can you talk about the positives?
Well, the positive was that after I finished medical school and my internship and my residency, which was in internal medicine, I specialized in endocrinology, which is the study of hormones, and then in neuroendocrinology, which is essentially brain chemistry. Now, this was at a time when there was a new technique that had been developed by two great scientists. One of them was a VA scientist. I happened to be in the VA system at that time. Her name was Rosalind Yalow. And she had won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for having perfected a technique called radioimmunoassay. So we were able to measure certain hormones and neuropeptides that were unmeasurable before. Today, everyone knows about these neurotransmitters, neuropeptides. Everybody's familiar with chemicals or hormones such as oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin. No opiates, but we didn't know that at that time, that these were also molecules of emotion, and they were also immunomodulators. And as a physician, I was puzzled by the fact that you could have two patients who had the same illness, saw the same physician, got the same treatment, had completely different outcomes. So one of my colleagues, Candice Pert, at that time, who later went on to become the director of brain chemistry at NIH, used the word molecules of emotion. And she also wrote a book on that subject. I asked her to write it, actually, and I wrote the foreword to that book. And so we had this insight that the mind and the body were connected through these chemical messengers that were produced not only in the brain, but everywhere else in the body, including the gut and the heart and you name it. And that suddenly the mind seemed to have escaped the brain. It seemed to be everywhere in the body, except in the mind it spoke in English with an Indian accent usually. So that was a breakthrough for me.
You know, you're talking about those neurotransmitters and chemical things. Can you connect that to one of the great things you've done for the world is bring awareness to the importance of meditation and what it can do. Do you believe that meditation increases our connection to creativity?
Yeah, because meditation done properly takes you beyond thought. And meditation is not a mental experience. It's an experience that allows you to actually go to the source of thought, which in Eastern wisdom traditions is called consciousness. So consciousness is that which makes any experience possible, including the experience that we call thinking. And of course, perception and everything else that is associated with the mind. And yet meditation is actually decreasing mental activity and ultimately transcending mental activity, where all creativity lies. Creativity is not a mental experience, because mind is, what we call mind is conditioned consciousness. So as soon as you're born, you start getting conditioned. You're given a name, a nationality, a gender, and all kinds of other attachments go with your name and your identity. So, you know, as soon as we are born, and then the whole process of education, we are basically indoctrinated into systems of thought. And these systems of thought have existed ever since human beings created language. So about 30, 40,000 years ago, we are told by deep historians that there were 8 or 9 different types of humans. We call ourselves Homo sapiens, which means the wise ones. We were humble enough to give ourselves that name. But then we gave names to other species too. Homo erectus, Homo Neanderthals, etc., etc. All these humans look like us, except all these humans, including us, had a very rudimentary language for basically danger and mating and food. But then Homo sapiens, our species, created a language for telling stories. And the first stories were gossip, which still are the most important stories of humankind. But then there were other stories, mythology, religion, philosophy, theology, cultural stories, historical stories, economic stories, stories of social justice, injustice, etc., etc. And now we have the latest story. It's called science, which is also a system of thought. So what, when we think, 99% of our thoughts are actually not original, unless you're, you know, once in a while, an Einstein or a Mozart or a Beethoven
or
a great writer comes along and they say something original. But 99.99% of our thoughts are recycled. They're recycled from other people's thoughts, social media, news, everything from movies to newspapers to social interactions. So actually the same mental structures have been recycling for thousands of years. Meditation allows you to occasionally go beyond these structures of thought. And in that space between thoughts, which actually was the first time I wrote about it in that book, Quantum Healing, where Ariel and I met for the first time in 1988. Once you go into the space between thoughts, so the space between any experience, space between sensation, images, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, that is what Eastern wisdom traditions call pure consciousness, which is without conditioning. What is awareness prior to its conditioning? And that's a field of not only infinite creativity, but also insight and intuition and imagination and higher vision and archetypes. And you go beyond that. If you go totally beyond all of that, you enter a realm of pure consciousness, which is infinite possibilities, what is also called non-local correlation, synchronicity, unpredictability. This is where attention and intention originate, and this is a realm where everything is inseparable or entangled with everything else. And if you incubate here, as in the deep sleep state, or even in the dream state, or even while daydreaming, or during meditation, then once in a while you go over beyond your habitual certainties, which interfere with the creative process.
Oh, man. That's not a tweetable, but it's damn no. quotable. You know, Deepak, when you're talking about going beyond, that's the whole point of this new book, MetaHuman. And right. I'm really excited to get to that. I have a couple more questions before that. You told Oprah years ago that you meditated every day for 40 years without ever missing a day. Is that still right. the case? Are you still on that roll?
Yeah, it's more than that now. It used to be that I used to meditate half an hour twice a day. And now my ritual in the morning is over 2 hours. I don't start my day before 11 a.m., usually unless I'm on the road or doing something special. And I don't actually work after 5 p.m. on regular days. So my work day is 11 to 5. And then I don't also, unless I'm on a tour or something, weekends are completely off. So I spend 2-3 hours in meditation, yoga, and breathing in the morning. And then before I sleep, I meditate again, up to an hour sometimes. Just before I go to bed, I also do something called yoga nidra, which is a meditation practice before you sleep. And I also meditate these days more and more on the human construct that we call death, because, you know, as we grow older, we have to start looking at that as well.
Yeah. Deepak, I know that you like to go into silence for long periods of time, several times a year. These periods of solitude and silence, do they figure into your book creations?
To some extent, Ariel, they do. These days I go into silence only once a year for 1 week. It's coming up actually in September, mid-September. I'll be doing that. And yeah, I get ideas. I don't write them down though. I write down my ideas every day in the morning. And then I use them for various things, either writing a blog or I just write a few paragraphs. And so it ends up that I'm not even writing a book. I'm just writing every day about something or the other. And soon it starts to gel into a book topic. So that's how it happens.
If you had to choose a title for yourself, doctor, scientist, or philosopher, which would you choose?
You know, every title, honestly, Linda, is limiting. So, and then, you know, you can find to that. So
yeah,
I'd rather not label myself. I think I'm still trying to decide what I'll do when I grow up.
Yeah, me too. Just when I think I figured it out, it changes again.
I know.
Crazy. Yeah.
Every identity we have is provisional. That's actually the whole point of MetaHuman.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, talking about MetaHuman, when I read the preface to the book, I got so excited because it felt like you were just talking to me, like we were having this deeply personal conversation, and you were sharing your lifelong curiosity about the biggest questions in life. So are you satisfied with how MetaHuman turned out? Did you answer your questions?
I did. To a great extent, I did. And I thought it would be my final book. And Linda, it is my 89th book right now.
Oh, Lord.
And so I thought that would be my final book. But now, having written it, I realized I have a little more to say. So I'm doing a book right now called The Awakened Life. And then I'll do one more after that, I think. It's called Matrix, Going Beyond the Rabbit Hole and Finding Fundamental Reality.
You should never say never because you told me that you were going to stop at 80.
Yeah,
and now we're at 91.
Right. That's the plan right now, to stop after the next
goodness.
Two books.
You know, one of the big questions to ask ourselves is life meaningful enough? How do you answer that question, Deepak?
In most people's lives are not meaningful, and that they are like biological robots that are bundles of conditioned reflexes and nerves that are constantly being triggered by people and circumstance. So most of our life is like a biological robot for most people. And once in a while, maybe someone actually starts to think about it and reflect on it. And once you start to ask yourself that question, as my life meaningful or does it have a purpose, then it does turn meaningful. But most people actually don't ask that question.
Really? I've been asking that question since I was like 2 years old.
Oh, really?
I started asking it recently.
So is that the question we need to ask ourselves? Like, what is it for me that's going to make life meaningful enough, or is there a better question?
Yeah, that's a very important question, but I think the better question is who or what is me? Who or what is I? And then an even better question is who wants to know who I am? What is it that wants to know who I am? And, you know, once you start going down that route, you start to actually realize that very few people actually know who they are. So, you know, most of us think we are biological organism. You know, I am Deepak Chopra. So who is Deepak Chopra? This guy who is now 73 years old or going to be, looks like this. This is his title, you know, choose one, doctor, philosopher, writer, or no label. He's male. He has a body and a mind. It turns out all of those assumptions are wrong. So that those are all assumed identities. You actually do not have a body. There is no such thing. All you experience is a shifting stream of sensory experiences. And some of those perceptual experiences, you identify with your body. You perceive your body the same way as you perceive a rainbow or a tree or a cup of coffee. I mean, you look at it, you can touch it, you can taste and smell it, and you can make sounds out of it. So it behaves like an object, but when you start to look at it very carefully, there's no object that can be found that you can call your body. You were once a fertilized egg, then you were a zygote, then you were an embryo, then you were a baby, then you were a toddler, and then you were a teenager, a young adult, on and on. So there's no such thing as a body. It's a verb. It's not a noun. And then when you look at the verb that you call a body, then you say, how do I know it exists? The only way you know it is perceptual activity. So you're interpreting perceptual activity, that to a changing perceptual activity, as something that you call a physical body. But actually, there isn't such a thing. And then when you say, oh, how about mind, intellect, ego, emotions, and you realize that those are also transient, ephemeral, evanescent, ungraspable thoughts and feelings and emotions. If I ask you to tell me what emotions or thoughts you were having last Tuesday at 4 p.m., you probably can't tell me. And yet you must have been thinking, right? So you don't have the same mind that you had yesterday, in all probability. You don't have the same emotional framework. You don't have the same personality that you had as a teenager. There's nothing to hold on to. So, you know, when you start asking, who am I, you start to go down this rabbit hole. You find there's no such thing as a body. And then you find that there's no such thing as a mind either. It's just fluctuations of consciousness that are like snapshots of experience, but they're strung together along the thread of memory or awareness. So we give them continuity when in fact every experience that you have, including this one that we're having right now, is a transient, evanescent, ephemeral, ungraspable experience. By the time you hear my words, they don't exist. By the time you look at anything, it doesn't exist. Now that's why the German philosopher Wittgenstein said, our life is a dream, we are asleep, but once in a while we wake up enough to know that we are dreaming. Yeah. So what do we wake up to is the subject of the book. We wake up to our identity, which is beyond these human constructs like birth and death and bodies and minds and egos and personalities and sensations and images and feelings and thoughts, to the source of all this, which is inherently free from all experience. So, you know, you as a being remain constant, but there's no such thing as a person. Because the person is also a process in consciousness. And all our problems come because we think we are persons and we look at other people or other sentient beings and we think they are also persons, when actually the person itself is a symbolic signature of a deeper reality, which is not in time. And therefore, you know, once you wake up to that, then all these constructs start to disappear, including the construct of a universe. You know, my last book was called You Are the Universe, which has basically made the point that there is no such thing as a universe. And so this book takes it further. If there's no universe, if there's no body, if there's no mind, then what is there? And, you know, people who've tried LSD will tell you there's a matrix from where all these experiences emerge, and that matrix is an entanglement of every sentient being, or what the new literature calls conscious agents, which are not in space and time. And this has been the perennial philosophy. It's not just Eastern or Vedantic or Buddhist. It's found in Judaic mysticism, in the Kabbalah, in Christianity, in Sufism, that there's a hidden reality which is infinite and not in space-time. If you're religious, you might call that God, or Ein Sof, or if you're not, you might call it non-local reality, the matrix, Ein Sof, Brahman, doesn't matter what you call it. But there's a fundamental ground of existence which is not physical. And everything that we call physical is actually a modified form of the non-physical. The formless experiences itself as form and phenomena. But when you look at form, you realize even that is misleading. There's no such thing as a form. Every form is a phenomenon, whether you look at it objectively or subjectively, and then every phenomenon emerges and subsides into the formless. So the formless, invisible self is the only reality. Everything that can be seen, perceived, thought of, imagined, conceptualized is not really the real reality. And this is now becoming part of the philosophy of science, slowly. What we call realism is under attack. So Einstein was what we call a naive realist. He thought that the picture of the world is exactly the way it looks. But it looks to you the way it looks like to you because you're using a human nervous system to observe it. It doesn't look the same to a bat that experiences the universe as the echo of ultrasound, a snake that navigates through infrared, or a butterfly that tastes the world through its legs and smells it through its antenna and hears it through its wings and looks at it through 30,000 lenses that move like a kaleidoscope. So what is the real picture of the world? And the answer is there's no such thing.
I need a shot at tequila right about now.
I know, seriously.
Deepak, the chapter in Metahuman on sudden genius just made me so happy. And the story about the Israeli man who went from being able to barely play the piano and then spontaneously he knows and understands music theory. Can you tell me how to be a sudden genius? Because I want to be instantly fluent in Italian language and cooking.
You have to give up everything that you thought was real.
Oh, Lord.
And you have to start questioning everything that you was certain about. And then you have to ask yourself, who is doing the questioning? Of course, these sudden geniuses can happen in brain injury because the normal brain is an editing device. It edits out everything that is not part of our structured hypnosis of social conditioning. So sometimes brain injury does it, sometimes brain tumors, children with autism, and sometimes meditation, you know, meditation will take you there consistently. Mm. And of course, these days, all this hype about hallucinogens and these,
microdosing
and all of that. And under certain circumstances, ayahuasca, all of that, they have a little role to play as well.
Yeah. Linda does this really fun thing on this beautiful writer's podcast called Rapid Fire. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions just to go really fast.
Right.
So I didn't pick this one because this one's really mean. If you had to go 1 year without one of these two things, which would you choose, coffee or yoga?
Oh.
See, I told you, Linda.
If I had to go 1 year without...
Without one of them.
I think I could go without coffee, but I would choose yoga because I'm addicted to it much more than I'm addicted to coffee.
Oh, oh God. What's your least favorite thing about publishing, and also what's your favorite thing about publishing?
I have grown to the point in my life independent of favorite or non-favorite things. I try to stay independent of hope and despair, good and bad, high and low, favorite or non-favorite.
Well, then you're going to...
The least favorite thing about publishing would be the inability of publishers to keep up with how to promote their books.
Oh, amen to that. Yeah, we've been there. Okay, I don't know if you have these, but if you do, would you tell us two of your guilty pleasures?
He doesn't have them anymore.
Well, I don't have guilt, so I don't believe in the concept of guilt. But I have many pleasures, including coffee, including certain kinds of food, including these days a taste for caramel chocolate. But I think guilt is an unnecessary word to apply to pleasure.
We agree. What's your favorite smell when you're in India?
It is sandalwood and just the smell of the earth after a good monsoon shower.
What living
Which is
person...
also a smell that you find in Hawaii.
Oh, that's true. Is there a living person you'd most like to have dinner with?
No, period.
Not even me?
Okay, yeah, I'd settle for you. But, you know, okay. I thought you were talking about public figures.
I
think all public figures, with the exception of a few, like our friend Marianne, are actually gangsters and thugs, and they've taken over the world, and they're destroying it. I'd rather not have dinner with them.
I totally agree, and I am so loving watching Marianne. We had her on the show a couple of years ago. And,
right,
and when
great.
I heard that she was running for president, I just thought, oh, gosh, that's probably not going to work out too well. And you know what? Whether or not she wins, she is making so many waves and spreading so much information and love. I am so proud of her.
Yeah, I agree. Totally
doing
agree.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, Deepak, what's your favorite city in the world?
New York City, right where I am this moment.
Okay. What's your most creative time of day?
Early morning after my meditation and yoga practice.
And if you weren't doing what you're doing now, would you be a musician or an artist, a filmmaker, a bodybuilder? What other career path would you take?
I would be a street poet.
Oh, I like that. What's the best thing your kids have taught you?
Not to take myself seriously.
Kids will do that.
Yes.
Okay, last question. What's your dream for MetaHuman?
You know, my dream is that if there were a critical mass of people tapping into their genius, which is every single child that is born. Tagore said every child that is born is proof that God has not given up on human beings. So my hope would be that if there's a critical mass of people who wake up from the waking sleep that they're in and stop being biological robots, then we could hope for a more peaceful, just, sustainable, healthier, and joyful world.
Amen. Deepak, early on in your career when you had those haters, you used to debate them, and very skillfully. In fact, you debated them not too many years ago, but you've let that go. And do you have any wisdom for people right now, writers who have the voice of the bully in their head or the voice of mean reviewers? What do you tell them?
I think there's two things. If you want to be independent of criticism, then you also have to be independent of flattery because they're both equally dangerous.
Oh.
And what happens is you become totally dependent for validation on others, and then you're either instantly flattered or perennially offended for the rest of your life. And that's not a good way to live.
sir. Who are you reading now, Deepak?
I am rereading a favorite person, favorite teacher. His name is Nisargadatta Maharaj, and the book is called I Am That.
That's Brian's favorite book. He's always got that.
Yeah, it's mine too, yeah.
Wow, I'm ordering right now.
If you had to explain MetaHuman, like in an elevator pitch, how are you explaining this book to people?
You are not a body. You are not a mind. You are not the experiences of the world. You are the source of all those experiences, body, mind, and the world. And those experiences are actually conceived, constructed, governed, and come into existence in your own being. So you're always the same being, but you're never the same person. So the shift from human to meta-human is to recognize that that which we call our personal self, the body, mind, and experience of the world, is a process in a more infinite self that is you. And that infinite self is formless, and it is eternal, and it is timeless. And when you identify with that, you experience extreme joy. You have the emergence of platonic values like truth, goodness, beauty, harmony, love, compassion, joy, equanimity. You also have the awakening of insight, intuition, creativity, imagination, archetypal vision. And most importantly, you lose the fear of death because you realize death happens to experiences and not to you. So the construct of death becomes invalid, as does the construct of birth. Timeless being is who we are, eternally and now. Knowing this allows you to participate in the creation of personal and collective reality.
I'm sorry.
Some of that.
That is so big. That is so big. And I've read the book. The book is stunning. In fact, I called Ariel at one point and I said, I'm obsessed with this book.
You.
I cannot stop reading. Now, let me ask you, you're talking enlightenment, right? What I'm getting from
this very complex
book is the simple notion, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but it's the very simple notion that there are as many different realities on this earth as there are people. So I'm taking this as there's over 7 billion of us, there's 7 billion realities or infinite realities, and we're all the star of our own movie. This illusory movie, but being the star of that movie doesn't really serve us like we think it does. We're lying to ourselves, thinking that our movie is so damn important. And I know I just said a lot, but I think...
That's partially correct, Lina, that's partially correct. You are having a unique experience of what you call reality, and that includes your own mind, and it includes your body, and includes the experiences that go along with the body. And the mind, those are uniquely yours. But then there are certain experiences that are species specific, that all human beings have the same regularities of experience. For example, you know, every morning the sun rises and every evening it sets. And then there are certain regularities of experience that we call biological rhythms that we all share, or what we call natural laws. So there's this reality that is specific to you as an individual soul, but then there's a reality which is common or in the background for all humans. But then there are other species that have their own realities. You know, what does the world look like to an insect with 100 eyes? So each of these is actually a unique reality on its own. Reality is individual, it is cultural, it is species specific, but it transcends the species. We live in our bubble of reality. Now, if you have a dog or a cat and you have a relationship with that, you know, your dog, when it barks, may not hear the same sound that you hear because it has a different nervous system. There's some kind of leakage in that bubble that is the dog's bubble and yours, and that's why you have a relationship with other species. In the book, I mention a woman who could speak to birds, and there are other people who have intra-species communication. So, you know, as the Beatles song said, the deeper you go, the higher you fly. you transcend each identity till you actually become one with the only absolute identity, which is infinite. Along the way, there are many stories to tell and many versions of reality. And they're all equally valid when you're having them. So reality is different in different states of consciousness. Knowledge is different in different states of consciousness, but your biology is also different in different states of consciousness. And your perception of the world is different in different states of consciousness. When you have deep empathy for anybody, you know, any sentient being, not a human being, or your dog, or your cat, then there is something that happens in that you begin to feel what others feel. That's the beginning of going over your personal dreamscape and entering the matrix of other dreamscapes. And then that deep empathy can lead to compassion and love and all the things that we value as human beings. But if you combine that exploration of deep empathy, compassion, and love with what is called transcendence, which is going beyond thought, then you open the door to dormant potentials like extrasensory perceptions, psychic phenomena, remembering past lives, looking at the future, remote healing. All these things that I thought in the past had no scientific validity, but now having looked at it myself, practiced these techniques myself, I see that we have dormant potentials that move in the direction of the infinite, that there is no reality that is not accessible to us. But all these realities are projections of an infinite consciousness that ultimately expresses itself as infinite knowers, infinite modes of knowing, and infinite things known. And of course, people say if it's all an illusion, then why bother? And the idea here is simply to upgrade the illusion, because right now the illusion has become a nightmare that is going to lead to the extinction of the wise species, Homo sapiens. The next extinction will be caused by human behavior. And we can avoid that if we go deeper into the nature of our existence.
So, Deepak, I have to ask you this question. So, everything you've just described, and Linda, you probably want to do this too, I want that. I want to be in that space. And
right. Is
it contagious? Like, if we come to Soho and come hang out with you and sit in the room with you, can we get there faster?
Now, you know, again, in spiritual traditions, there's a value of some people being in the presence of an awakened being, and it's called darshan or direct transmission. And I think that's very valid, but it won't happen with Deepak. I'm too much in the realm of thought right now.
You know,
so go hang out with Amma or somebody else.
Amma or somebody like that.
Okay. Or a child.
Amma, for sure. I have a friend, Deepak. Actually, she's a really dear friend of my sister's. My sister's known her for a long time. And she has reached a state of enlightenment. And it wasn't something she was cognizant of. It wasn't something she tried to attain.
Right.
But it just happened. And it's that kind that Dr. Jeffrey Martin writes about in The Finders, where
she's
the same person, but she's blissful. She's a comedian, so she's still funny.
But she's a different person.
Yeah, that's right. She's not plagued by things she was plagued by anymore. Her mind is very quiet. Her mind is quite calm.
Yeah.
And
there are certain signs. One is the quiet mind. The second is you're not victimized by memory, even though your memory is sharper. You're less melodramatic, and you have access to unlimited creativity, but you also are deeply compassionate and have deep empathy for others.
But as a storyteller, it kind of scared me a little bit. Carol said to me, do you want to go hang out with her and she can give us some pointers? You know, Carol's thinking, let's get enlightened. And I'm like, I don't know. Will I still be able to tell stories? I mean, she's doing it, but the ultimate.
Yeah, you have to first go beyond all stories, and then you can choose the stories that amplify the experience of joy and get rid of the other ones. There are lots of stories that don't help us.
Sure. Deepak, do you ever think about if
we did hit critical mass and society became filled with metahumans, what would that look like?
It would be very magical. We would all have beyond normal abilities. Everybody these days talks about out-of-body experiences when, in fact, the real mystery is the in-body experience. There's no one inside your body. There's no little Deepak inside my brain looking out at the world through the eyes. So you're not in the body. The body is in you. You theoretically should be feeling out-of-body all the time, non-local, blissful, lightness of being.
Mm. That's nice.
I get there sometimes, but not enough.
You talk about the zone as it relates to creativity, Deepak, and how corporations would love to monetize this quote-unquote zone, but that aha moments are tricky and creativity is elusive.
It's elusive because it can't be forced. So creativity is basically a leap into context, meaning, relationship, story, and identity. And that leap is literally a quantum leap. In fact, that's what true creativity is. Otherwise, you can simulate creativity through an artificial intelligence system, which is based on algorithms. So it simulates creativity, and most creativity is simulated creativity. But true creativity is also disruptive. You have to go beyond thought. You have to surrender to uncertainty, and you have to let the meta-reality, the bigger reality, do the unconscious processing for you, that aha moment. For me, by the way, I cultivate that even in deep sleep. I think deep sleep is probably the best incubator for creativity, along with deep meditation and questioning your habitual modes of thinking and experiencing.
Yeah, I woke up with my first book. It was actually given to me in a dream with 6 books, titles and format and pages and pages. And the dream continued for 6 months. I would wake up every night at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, that's very good. That's classic, actually, even for scientific discoveries. That's what happens.
I get all my biggest ideas in the bathtub.
That's good. Archimedes got his ideas in the bathtub, too.
A lot of our readers wonder about prayer or ways in which they can access their muse more easily. And I always just say one of the things I think I was doing, Deepak, before that dream that I had in 1994, I believe, was I was asking questions. I was like, what is it about my life that's working? And what is it that I can pass on to my child that maybe will benefit him in realizing some of his greatest dreams? And I was just kind of ruminating about things. And I often wonder if that's why that dream came to me. Was there ever a specific question that you asked that elicited dreams or anything that you did beyond prayer or meditation that was real specific?
I think reflective inquiry is the only way, actually, to access creativity. So, you know, Heisenberg, the great physicist, said that nature never reveals herself to us as she is, but as exposed to our method of questioning. The question is the answer. So if you live the questions, you'll move into the answers. Asking questions like, who am I? What do I want? What's my purpose? What am I grateful for? These are the most fundamental questions. And then you can go from there. But the more you live the questions, the more likely you are to move into the answers.
Well, is there anything special you do when you go to sleep? Do you have a special blankie or lavender oil?
No, I actually do this practice where I slowly, it's a yogic practice called pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses. So first I withdraw from visual experience, then I withdraw from sound experience, then I withdraw from sensation experience, then I withdraw from sensation experience into breath experience, and finally into thought experience, and then allow everything to settle down. And then just before I go to sleep, I ask maybe one or two questions, and then I rest in awareness, and my attitude is that deep sleep is the window to infinite creativity. That's it.
More better sleep. Okay, I love that.
Taking notes.
You know, in the Eastern wisdom tradition, there are 3 states of consciousness that we go through every day: sleeping, waking, and dreaming. But then there are other states like soul consciousness or cosmic consciousness, divine consciousness, God consciousness, unity consciousness, Brahman consciousness. Each of these states weaves a different reality for you. And so it's a lot of fun trying to navigate these different states of consciousness.
I, for one, have been really nervous about artificial intelligence. But your book made me feel less worried that it's going to take over the world and destroy us. Because I think this one line you said was so funny. You said the process is totally mechanical. A laptop saying, I love you, doesn't really mean it.
Yeah, it doesn't, because it doesn't feel that. It's programmed to say that. But having said that, by the way, I have been working on a stealth project for the last 3 years where I've created my mind twin, and I'll be releasing this in November. And this guy can, he looks like me, talks like me, has the same accent. He has a good sense of humor, but he knows a lot more than I do because he's read everything I've written, but also everything I've read. Wow. And after I die, he will continue to evolve with other such mind twins. And so the future is already here. And these avatars, these artificial intelligence avatars, they will evolve as they interact with other human beings and with other avatars. Now, of course, anything new like that is disconcerting. But for me, this is actually very revealing because we are already living in a simulation. And so we're just extending it through VR and artificial intelligence and dreamscapes. The key is to go back to the source always. No matter what your projected reality is, the source still is pure consciousness, and that's who we are.
I love that saying you have, that at no point in history did waking up go viral.
That's right, but now it might.
I'm hoping it does. I think we need to wake up, and it needs to happen fast.
Yeah, let's hope. Otherwise, the universe might be saying the human species was a good experiment that didn't work.
No. Are you optimistic?
No, I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I'm a realist. It could go either way. And either way is fine. I mean, you know, we are not the most important species on this planet. We are the predators, if anything. So if you understand yourself as beyond being human, meta-human, then it really doesn't matter. You make mistakes and then you correct them and you move on.
So when your physical body goes, what's your expectation of where you will be?
See, that's the most fundamental question and can be answered with one simple sentence. There is no such thing as a physical body. There are only sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, and perceptions, which are excited states of pure being. And so just like you wake up in the morning after a deep sleep, that cycle of deep sleep, dream, and waking is at every level, from microcosm to macrocosm. And so there is no birth, there is no death, and there's no physical world, and there's no physical body. It's just you having an experience, and then you are identifying with a narrow band of experiences that you call your mind and your body and the world. But that's a very limited band of experience. The human bandwidth of experience, say visual, is between 300 and 800 nanometers. Now, you're not normally, unless you have sophisticated instruments, you're not experiencing infrared or ultraviolet or infrasonic or any of the bandwidths that other species can experience, and there's an infinite range of experiences available to you. But you're so used to the daily experience of daily, everyday projected reality and so attached to it that you think that is reality. It's not. Birth is not the opposite of life. Birth is the opposite of death, and death is the opposite of birth, and life is the continuum of both. If you stop death, we would all be living fossils in a fossilized universe in a museum. You don't want that, you know. So it is death that makes birth possible and birth that makes death possible. And that is happening every nanosecond. Every thought is born and dies instantly. Every emotion is born and dies, unless you hold on to it, in which case you suffer anyway. So the fact is these are human constructs. When I die, what will happen to my body? I never dies. I is not in space or time. Only things in space and time die. And so I does not die because it was never born. What is born and dies is experience, and it's always happening now in what we call the eternal now. The rest is a story, and, you know, you can upgrade or downgrade the stories. So when religious traditions talk about lokas or bardos, or today scientists talk about multiverses, different dimensions of space and time, these are all equally real or equally projected. You can choose. So if New York City is real, then heaven, hells, and purgatories and lokas and bardos are equally real. If New York City is not real, then those are also equally unreal, because they're not locations in space-time. They're domains, frequency domains of states of consciousness. Everything we do in our life is to experience a state of consciousness, which we call joy, happiness, security, immortality, loss of extinction, etc. Everything every day we do is in that direction. So it's built into our system to experience expanded higher states of consciousness. But ultimate reality is not a state of consciousness. It's just the purest possible state which embodies every other state. And I say every other, I mean infinite states. Because infinity or infinite being can only express itself as infinite experiences. So it's your destiny to have infinite experiences. And this particular lifetime of ours is, as the Buddha said, transient as autumn clouds. He said to watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at the movements of a dance. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. But when you ground yourself in timeless being, it all becomes the play of consciousness. And play is fun.
Speaking of fun, I love how at the end of the book you have a month of awakening. You have these exercises.
Right. I'm going to expand on those, by the way, through animation and through videos and all of that, because those exercises are pretty sequential, but they're still not the easiest unless you've read the book.
Right, right. Well, and you say that waking up is supposed to be effortless. So is there one...
It is effortless if you're innocent, like a child.
Wow.
Or if you're innocent, like some people that we know that haven't been bamboozled by education. Otherwise, it's not so easy.
Before we close, is there one particular exercise that our...
Just ask yourself, who am I? Just ask yourself, who am I? Then ask yourself, am I the changing body? Am I the changing, evolving intellect? Am I the changing mind? Am I the changing emotions? Am I the changing relationships? Am I the changing scenery? And then see what happens. You're not the changing scenery. You're the ever-present seer in the midst of that changing scenery.
Thank you, Deepak. Profound.
Thank you.
Profound. I would say my head hurts, but it actually does.
No, my head feels like champagne bubbles are going through.
Oh, good, good. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Ariel.
All right, well, good luck with MetaHuman. This book is a game changer, Deepak. I think it is.
Let's hope. Let's see. It's fine. Let's see. Put it out there and let the universe handle the details.
We should all do that with our books. Let's put it out there, Ariel, and just let the universe handle it.
Just let go.
All right. Love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you both. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Ariel, are you still there?
I'm here.
Dude, he is deep.
I really do need some tequila.
Should we put this in the show? I think we should put this in the show. But my head isn't hurting. I'm kind of proud of
myself. No. My head feels really good. It's just that I would say on a physical, emotional, visceral level, I get it.
Yeah.
And then my poor brain is screaming, what the, you know, what? I didn't quite get that. How do you string all those words together? But, you know, for me, that's always been the magic of Deepak. I always said to him, listen, your audience, nobody understands a word you're saying. they just feel so good to hear you say it.
That's
because
exactly
there's some level at which they know that you're sharing reality or truth with them, and you probably wouldn't call it reality, so you're sharing your illusion with them, but in a way that feels like we're floating in a gentle, warm, nurturing sea.
Yeah, it feels like somebody knows what's happening. Okay, there's somebody that's got a handle on this, at least.
Oh, geez. Yeah, well, you know what? I still think there's a level at which if you hang out with people who are woke, like big-time woke,
yeah,
we might wake up too.
I love it. I hope so. Okay, sister. That was fun as hell.
That was so great. All right. Love you so much.
Love you too. Bye, babe.
Bye.
Ariel wants to drink and I just want to dance. Thank you for playing with us, you guys. I am so excited to hear what you think about MetaHuman. Do me a favor, since it's my birthday, I didn't tell you that, but it's true. Pre-order the book now while it's top of mind. And then once you've read it, let me know what you think on any of my social media posts about this episode. I love hearing from you. The online worlds of Deepak Chopra and his foundation are vast, of course, but you can start over at deepakchopra.com. As for Ariel, if you're looking for your soulmate or you want to turn your current mate into your soulmate, how's that for a trick? All the latest and greatest relationship intel lives over at soulmatesecret.com. And you know what's most exciting to me right now? I've got my hands on several of Ariel's press releases to her hit books, and I want to share them with you. You may know that every 4 or 5 years, I teach a 5-week live online book proposal course based on Your Big Beautiful Book Plan, my digital course co-authored with Danielle Laporte. Well, this time around, in a few weeks, along with all sorts of new proposal samples, I'm going to be sharing Ariel's press releases that you can use to uplevel your own book promotion. If you've ever wondered how a publisher would promote a woman who has launched more than 12 number one New York Times bestsellers for others, including for Marianne Williamson, Jack and Mark of Chicken Soup for the Soul fame, and Gary Zukav, this is your peek behind the scenes. The site for this course will be live soon, so sign up for my newsletter over at bookmama.com or follow me on social media and you'll be the first to have that info. Okay. If you've received any gifts from this show, the greatest birthday gift you can give to me is to leave your love and or 5 stars over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. Big, big thanks to Kevin Baker at Red Room Sound for his audio engineering mastery and to Julia McPherson at Inner Space Marketing for our beautiful graphics. And to you, our loyal listeners, especially you binge listeners. Sheesh, I'm out of words. Just so grateful. To infinite creativity and beyond. Right on.